Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Back in the late 1990s, lawmakers tussled for months over a plan to deregulate electric utilities in the state of Ohio. The effort was supposed to produce a process that kept utility prices down. Some 10-plus years later, a typical Columbus household pays 41% more for electricity than it did 5 years ago, and a small business, they're grappling with a 51% jump. That's more than three times the rate of inflation during that period. And I know all of this from reading the recent series by Dispatch business reporter Dan Guarino. He's with us today by phone for a few minutes to talk about the series. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Glad to be here, Ann.
So before the law, the deregulation law was enacted in 1999, our electricity rates were directly tied to the cost to provide service. And now it's been replaced with a process, kind of a one-of-a-kind hybrid, you call it. What's the difference between the way it was before and the way it is now?
Well, the way it was before, there's a couple different names for it. Some people call it cost-based regulation. Some people call it rate of return-based regulation. But basically, it says that the company can get repaid for all of its expenses plus a small profit. The size of the profit will vary, but a lot of times it's around 10%. And what that entails is the regulator trying to determine how much these things should cost or how much they do cost, and allowing the company to basically recover all those costs. And along with that, the utilities are monopolies. In a system like that, you basically get a guarantee of profit in exchange for having a territory in which you are the only provider.
Okay.
And in the system that's existed since the deregulation law, it's kind of taken steps toward more of a competitive system while it maintains some elements of a regulated system. And it, to a certain extent, it varies depending on the different utility territories in the state. But here in Central Ohio, you've still seen regulators setting the rates, which is an element that is something more common in a regulated system than an unregulated system. And at the same time, you're seeing competition, which means that if you want to, you can go out and get your electricity generation service from another provider. Now, for the most part, there have not been that many options available in the Columbus area for a long time. There are in the last few months for a lot of different reasons. But so you essentially had a system that was officially competitive and officially deregulated, except for most of that time there were few, if any, choices, and the rates were set by regulators. So it's kind of a little bit of one and a little one of the other.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Guarino. He's a reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We're talking about his recent series over the Sunday and Monday on electric utility deregulation, the ups and the downs, and whether it's been good for us as consumers or not. Critics blame both the legislature and the PUCO, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. Is there plenty of blame to go around or what?
There is. There's the things that were done in the legislature and by the regulators, and then there's a whole host of external factors. So I guess if you start out by saying there were a whole bunch of factors going on in the national market for electricity and in just the national economy that were making deregulation difficult. A lot of the folks I spoke to said that even if you discount, or even if you look at the things that occurred beyond those external factors, there were still a lot of different ways that the legislature and regulators made it so that this system was going to have a very difficult time succeeding, regardless of the economy and other things.
It's notable that Enron, now defunct, it was the company that first brought the idea to the Ohio General Assembly. I remember I was covering the General Assembly at the time, and I remember being visited by an Enron representative.
Well, Enron was, at the time, they were one of the leading leading supporters of this idea that energy markets will save customers money if you have competition. And this was something, at the time, in the 90s, this was something that was almost an article of faith for a lot of people. And you have to remember that at the time, we were looking at different utility territories in the country where a lot of customers felt like they had rates that were inappropriately high, and they were inappropriately high, and there was no other choice. So, and because of that, when you have somebody coming and saying, well, if you just open this up to competition, you'll have all these competitors coming in trying to offer the lowest prices, and customers will benefit. That was a really persuasive argument in a lot of places. I mean, it was a persuasive argument in California. It was a persuasive argument in the parts of Ohio that had high rates at the time, which included Cleveland and Toledo and parts of the northern in the northern part of the state.
But not Columbus.
Not Columbus. At the time, the other utilities in Ohio, AEP, Dayton Power and Light, and Duke Energy, which actually I believe became Duke Energy around that time, they had fairly low rates, and there were a lot of reasons for that. One was they heavily relied on coal power, which is really inexpensive. They also had they relied on power plants that were largely paid for already. While at the same time, the utility that served Northern Ohio, First Energy, they had some really expensive investments in nuclear plants that were, you know, that still needed to be paid off, and there was a whole series of concerns about the cost of those plants and how those costs were getting passed on to consumers. So it was really kind of a two different worlds in terms of electricity prices. And the way it works in Ohio is you could be a business in AEP territory, and then the business across the street could just happen to be in First Energy territory, and you could see, you know, a substantial difference in prices, even though you're competing against that business. And it was the kind of thing that a lot of political leaders and business leaders thought was a real problem.
So have customers, I mentioned at the beginning that in Central Ohio, typical Columbus household pays 41% more for electricity than it did 5 years ago. Has there been a proportional increase in customers from First Energy up in the northern part of the state?
No. Well, it's, and I should preface that by saying that whenever you look at prices, electricity prices are an incredibly slippery topic because there's a whole bunch of different ways of looking at it. And what you have, you can look at an individual's price, you can look at average prices. The numbers you're referring to are the typical prices, which is kind of taking a hypothetical typical customer. And this is from a survey that the Public Utilities Commission does every month, and it's from their October survey. But while prices have gone up for AEP customers and for Duke Energy customers and Dayton Power and Light customers, the increases have either been smaller, or if you adjust for inflation, there have even been some decreases for customers in First Energy territory. And the main reason for that is First Energy embraced the competitive market more so than the other utilities in Ohio, and right now prices on the competitive markets are really, really low. A lot of people will say that this is not a long-term phenomenon. This is something that's going to, you know, those prices are going to go up. But right now, at this kind of snapshot of this very specific moment in time, there are certain First Energy customers who are paying less than AEP customers, which is just completely different than it would have been 10, 12 years ago.
There's a big part of your reporting looks at the politicization of the process. The PUCO is supposed to represent the consumers, particularly now that the Office of the Consumers Council has been gutted in the last budget. They cut their budget in half from about $8 million to about $4 million. In fact, you know, one of your sources for the story resigned because of the problems he saw in the PUCO's consumer complaint section. Tell us about that.
Well, what they told me in this the employee you're referring to was someone who I believe left in the late, I think it was 2007 or in the late 2000s. Mm-hmm. And what he and several other people spoke about was that they felt like they would get customer complaints, they would see evidence of problems, and that they would just have a very, very difficult time enforcing the rules. When they were helping customers, and this is something that's not in the story, but one of the things that one of them told me was that if you wanted to help a customer, you were much better going straight to the utility and just telling them about a customer's problem and seeing if the utility would fix it. Because if you tried to work within the kind of the formal mechanism of the complaint process and trying to, if you see a pattern of complaints for specific companies, if you tried to actually do something administratively or from a have the regulators do something, it would be, you know, it would be very, very difficult. So they felt like they were kind of having to not really work around the system, but the system wasn't working the way it was supposed to, as they saw it.
There was also a problem with, one of the things the staff does is they write up recommendations, and sometimes this can take many weeks, many months, and they put a lot of time into it, and then they make their recommendations to the commission. And there was at least one case you talked about, but there was talk of others where those were rewritten.
And this is something that, you know, in any office where you're writing things that are eventually going to be published, you do see just editing.
Sure, you know, I worked in a newspaper.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
I get that.
So the question is, what you know, how much editing is too much, and at what point are you removing things that are findings of fact that are important, and at what point are you just merely adding commas and, you know, making the sentences make a little more sense? And mm-hmm. there are times, particularly in this period in the early 2000s, when employees said that they would see their reports just absolutely gutted, you know, where you're removing just about, you know, just key points, and then the result is pretty much scrubbed of so many of the things that the companies might not like, and it was something that was a real source of frustration. And there were a couple examples. Back in 2003. The plain dealer of Cleveland did a story about this happening, and in my story this week we cite another example from 2002, and those were two of the more notable ones. There was also, you know, there's also examples that maybe are not quite as egregious, but are, you know, kind of indicative of what the employee said was just a system that wasn't working very well.
As far as the politicization goes, it's difficult the way the PUCO is set up now in terms of its public hearings, and they say everything's very open in terms they have public testimony and that kind of thing. But when you're an individual consumer going up against a big company, there's not a lot of balance there.
Well, you know, there are public hearings, and I've gone to a fair number of these public hearings, and the public deserves part of the blame, if you will, for the fact that in a lot of ways the system doesn't pay attention to their interests as much as it possibly should, because they don't participate. They don't go to the public hearings. They don't really make their voices heard.
But isn't the PUCO supposed to, as the governor Kasich made the point he made was when he cut it in half? Or, by the way, that had no impact on the state budget and the $8 billion shortfall that they were dealing with last year. But when he made the point that the PUCO represents the individual consumer.
It does. Well, the PUCO represents everybody. I mean, they're supposed to be kind of the judge and the regulator. And they're supposed to balance the interests of everyone, including the company, the utility companies, all businesses, all consumers. And, you know, their mandate is to come up with solutions that are, you know, that are fair. And kind of for that to work, you need to, you know, attempt to, you know, come up with solutions that are fair and have a process that encourages that. But you also need the different parties to participate and to make their voices heard. And the Consumers Council is a group that that is kind of, you know, a lot of ways the lawyer, the attorney for the consumers. And they at one time several years ago would have had a really, really loud voice in mm-hmm. advocating on behalf of consumers in these cases.
But now their budget's been cut, and that affects their ability.
Yeah, now they're going through a real transition. They're in the process of hiring a new head of that agency, mm-hmm. And there. I mean, it's like any organization that sees half of its funding cut. They lost a lot of people, and they're just kind of trying to figure out kind of how they're going to function going forward. And they obviously are going to have to change their identity a little bit, because they don't have the resources to participate in as many cases and to do as many things as they did before.
Dan Guarino, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dan Guarino, he's a business reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. You can find his series at dispatch.com. We'll have that link for you at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Coming up, Scott Rob wrote a book about LeBron James, or sort of wrote a book, about LeBron James. We'll learn more about that right after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, American drones are everywhere now, down and on display in Tehran, for sale to our allies, even doing law enforcement in the USA. We'll look at drone proliferation. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. 41 degrees with some light rain in downtown Columbus. Expect showers off and on throughout the day, a high near 47. Rain is likely tonight with temperatures staying in the mid-40s overnight. And the rain continues tomorrow, a little warmer with a high of 58 degrees. There's still a chance of rain tomorrow night, but that chance decreases in the evening, a low of 42. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The whole LeBron James Cleveland Cavaliers story is complicated and emotional and for many just plain sad, no more so than in a new book by Cleveland native and Esquire columnist Scott Robb. The name of the book is The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. Scott Robb is on the phone with us today to talk about the book. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Good morning, Ann.
For our listeners, I have a question. About a year and a half has passed since LeBron James announced he would be taking his talents to Miami, as he put it. Were you one of the bitter ones? Has that bitterness endured? Give us a call and tell us why or why not. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, you know, you can go on All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there as well. So, Scott Robb, the title of your book is Harsh. Players leave teams all the time. Why call him a whore in the title? What's that about?
One of the odd things about the title, and of course many people have pointed out, hey, wait a minute, you're calling this fellow a whore and you're selling a book based on his fame.
I hadn't thought of it that
way. Hey, I don't want to plead guilty to committing an act of irony here, but as serious as that little bit of invective is, it's a little bit funny, at least to me. The other part of it, and I think I speak for at least a few Cleveland fans when I say that for seven seasons, a lot of what we heard from LeBron was along the lines of, oh, baby, this is so good. This is fantastic. I would never want to be anywhere else. I'm not saying that was a contractual commitment on his part, but he said many of the right things. There were red flags, to be sure. But there was that sense of waking up one morning and finding an empty wallet, an empty bed, and all of a sudden he's on TV with another team. And it was tough. And so the title, I think, reflects some of the anger and some of the outrage. And to the extent that it's a profound insult, I also think that it's sports. You know, that there's a passion that we bring to that little corner of the world that, for a lot of guys, maybe a sublimation of their most belligerent and aggressive instincts. To me, that's part of it, too, just part of being a fan and throwing insults.
You know, I looked up the word whore, and I got the third definition was a person considered as having compromised principles for personal gain. Did he ever, you know, by the way you describe him and in all of his background, I have to wonder, did he ever have any quote-unquote principles? He was tapped as a prodigy in the ninth grade. How are you going to develop principles in that kind of atmosphere with what they do to kids these days in those kind of circumstances?
I think that's a very astute observation. This was a young man who had to make a decision about going to high school, and he chose St. Vincent St. Mary, a private Catholic, almost all Caucasian school, and the outrage that people in West Akron felt, who expected him to go to Akron-Buchtel, the public school, almost all African American, the outrage was not dissimilar from what a lot of Cleveland fans felt after the decision. They were livid, and they felt every bit as betrayed by what they considered his treachery. And you know, he's a guy who was on the cover of Sports Illustrated magazine as a high schooler and called the chosen one. And I don't think it is fair to expect a guy that age. He'll be 27 the end of this month. It is in many ways unfair to ascribe some level of thoughtfulness, consideration of the impact of his behavior upon others. These have been business decisions for LeBron and the people around LeBron since a very early age.
My guest is Scott Robb. He's author of The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. If you have a question or comment for Scott, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Scott, when you started writing this book, it wasn't necessarily about him leaving. It was going to be about a year with the Cavaliers, right?
I was hoping to write the happy book, not to get too biblical about it.
You didn't want to be bitter.
Well, I knew, being a native Clevelander and a Cleveland fan, I knew it wasn't going to end the way I wanted it to, but there was a sense every time LeBron was on the court, the Cavaliers arguably had the best player in the game. And there was a sense at the beginning of every season, the team has a chance to go all the way, and that really is the book I set out to write.
You know, some reviews of The Whore of Akron have mentioned that the book is more about your life than it is about LeBron James's life. And I thought, as I got about two-thirds of the way through it, no, wait, this is about Cleveland.
I think it's all of the above. Mm-hmm. I certainly had no master plan for the book, especially after the decision. I was just determined to slog through a year of fresh hell, watching a Cavaliers team bereft of LeBron play horribly and not even try to win many nights, and to watch this Miami Heat, to visit Miami, get to know that city a little bit, and I was certain the Heat were going to win the championship. As my quest proceeded, there were questions raised really by people who were telling me to get over it. Or there were points where I felt, and I think other sports fans, I think it's not unusual for sports fans around the world to hope that if a player is killing your team, he gets injured. And I wrote about that. And, of course, people said, how could you be such a hater? And I really did start to question some of the first principles of fanhood for me, which was my unbelievably deep and passionate attachment to my hometown and to those teams. And so the book kind of became a search for my own soul or parallels between what one fan felt from one particular place and what all these people around the globe bring to being a sports fan when you know it's a business. And yet these myths and legends and narratives are passed down, especially in a Rust Belt town like Cleveland, from father to son, father to daughter, and the heroes and the villains. There's a certain degree of narrative majesty to all this, but it really sounds silly ultimately.
Lawrence and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Lawrence.
Hi there, Ann. Hello, Mr. Robb. Nice to speak with you. I want to know if you could comment, and I'll preface this saying I went to Ohio State, speaking from a school that is legendary in its passion for a sport. Akron, Cleveland, Toledo, the whole area is a dying area by all respects of the country economically. It has greater issues than simply sports. Can you comment on why maybe the problem is not with LeBron James, but maybe the problem with these people is the fact that they are linking so much of their happiness and so much of their energy on a sport and a human being that does nothing but put a ball in a hoop? And can you comment on why that is so important to that area of the country, specifically, you know, a high school star?
Scott Robb?
It's a great question. I think since I'm one of those people, it's tough for me to stand outside. And part of the book was an effort to do so, but I don't know if I succeeded or not. I think I don't think it's gender specific, although I kind of do. I think it's for a lot of men. you know, sports in any society, whether it's thriving or whether it's in the kind of despair that Cleveland, Akron, Northeastern Ohio has been in for decades now, I think sports is a place where we put a lot of these emotions, have nothing to do with the kind of rational thought that that question really displays. And I know that it's glib. I mean, anything that you say in terms of LeBron having made a positive economic impact, I think has to be supported by numbers I don't have. But I do think in a city like Pittsburgh, for example, which has suffered many of the same problems over the same years as Cleveland, a team like the Steelers, as ridiculous as it may sound, gives the citizens of Pittsburgh a sense of pride and a sense of dignity that's almost entirely missing now from Cleveland sports fans, where two generations of folks have kind of internalized the worst of their national image. And you could say for good reason. After all, 60 Minutes led its show Sunday night with a 15-20-minute segment on foreclosure and focused entirely on Cleveland as an example. LeBron James could not have undone any of that, nor is it fair to burden any young athlete with the hopes and the dreams and the despair and the desperation of a place that really has been going downhill for decades.
Thank you, Lawrence.
Thank you.
Take care. You know, you wrote how LeBron just didn't get it when people started burning his jersey after he announced his departure. Maybe the ones burning the jersey were never LeBron fans anyway, he said. And in not so many words, you wrote, no kidding. What's the difference between LeBron fans and Cleveland fans?
I think you love LeBron because he's playing for your team. You don't love the Cavaliers because LeBron James is playing. Now, there were millions of fans with no attachment to Cleveland or the Cleveland Cavaliers who, after the decision, turned on LeBron, and he's now booed in many NBA cities whenever the ball touches his hands. Those fans like the story, too. They like the idea of a homegrown hero, someone who spoke about loyalty and spoke about his understanding of the fans, the history of sports in the area, and all of that. So for LeBron, after the decision, to say those people weren't, maybe they were never LeBron James fans to begin with, is an indication of you could say narcissism, but it's really tone deafness. It's an inability to understand how sports really work. And again, maybe that's perfectly not just understandable and forgivable, but natural to a guy who at a very early age understood that he was a superstar.
Throughout the story, you pull out a ticket, the ticket out of a little Ziploc bag, I guess. The ticket represents all your hopes and dreams for the team, and you actually offered to give it or at least loan it to the owner of the Cavs, Dan Gilbert. He wouldn't take it. Tell us about that ticket.
Well, I was 12 years old, and my Uncle Manny had season tickets for many years, and he was a good-hearted guy, and he took me to see the Browns every week they played at home at a time when the Browns were a paragon of excellence in the NFL, and at a time when Cleveland thought well of itself, and that whole layer of blue-collar humans with good jobs and great communities were Cleveland. And so for me, it represents the ticket. It's not much good as a talisman, obviously. It hasn't brought Cleveland or me any great luck in terms of sports. But it represents the kind of glory that Cleveland may never see again in terms of socioeconomic status. But as long as they have these major league teams, and as long as I'm a crazy Cleveland sports fan, it could happen.
Frank in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Good morning. What I'm interested in, as I search back in my memory, is the Carlos Boozer incident, where I believe LeBron, in my mind, turned his back on the city there by not trying to keep Carlos on the team or accepting the contract, and that would have been the second star on the team. Can you expand on that at all, please?
Sure. My understanding, and I think it's generally agreed upon, is that Carlos Boozer had a verbal agreement with the owner of the Cavaliers, Mr. Gund, at the time, and the general manager, Jim Paxson, at the time, that if they agreed to not re-sign him, which they had the right to do at a very low second-year salary, that he would re-sign with the Cavs, that he wouldn't shop himself around. I'm not sure that LeBron had anything to do with it. In other words, Boozer and his wife, when they received an offer from the Utah Jazz that was preemptively designed to make the Cavs unable to match it, they reneged on their agreement with the owner and general manager of the Cavaliers and made that decision. LeBron was a rookie, and I'm not sure what the impact of Boozer's, I would say, betrayal had on LeBron, but I don't think LeBron has ever been held responsible for Boozer's decision, nor do I think he should be.
Frank, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to know at this point whether your impressions of LeBron James in the book would have been the same if he had never left. But even before he announced he would leave, you don't make him sound very nice or very deep. And yet, the last time you actually spoke with him was after the last game of the regular season in 2010. You gave him a little speech. He smiled. Everybody was happy. That was before you knew that he might leave.
One of the things about sports, and I'm not going to claim it's a fine art, but it inspires the kind of love. But after all, does it make any sense to read a Yeats poem and feel your heart swell? It's not a rational reaction. Whether it's sculpture, whether it's opera, whether it's a painting, whether it's poetry, we respond to these things on a level that's really visceral and all-encompassing. And that's, for me at least, what LeBron James inspired in terms of his pure game. It wasn't about winning championships to watch LeBron when he was a Cavalier, but of course that was always the hope. But there was also a level of greatness in his game that I found compelling. And when I spoke to him, and I had been around the whole season, and I had seen how walled off, how disconnected he really was from the media to a degree that shocked me. I mean, we're talking about folks in the media who had covered him since high school, and when they would meet on media day after months, there wasn't even that nod of recognition between LeBron and men that he had been talking to for many years. I'm not talking about how's the family.
Right.
Just the merest nod of recognition.
Just, hey.
Hey, stop, anything. But the truth is, April rolled around of the season before he left, and I was about to head back home. I knew I'd be back for the playoffs, but that's a crazy time, and I just stepped away from the journalist or reporter pose and said, I've seen the greats. You know, I'm of a certain age. You're the best basketball player I've ever seen.
We have an email from Aaron. He writes, do you think LeBron's lack of leadership and a need, in a way, to follow as opposed to lead has to do with his upbringing and lack of a father figure in his life? He followed friends to a high school and now to the Heat.
I think that's an important point, and it's one really ends the book in some ways. I grew up without a father in the house after the age of 10. I was thousands of miles away during a period of time where people didn't make long-distance calls. And you know, I still carried around the sense of being loved by a father, of what he smelled like when we were wrestling on the floor, all that stuff that meant a lot to me, along with the yearning. LeBron had none of that. And one of the striking things about LeBron, when he went to Miami, he talked about how easy it was going to be to win championships. And one of the strangest things to me is the idea that however gifted or talented you are, where is that sense that it's usually embedded, whether it's a father, whether it's an uncle, older brother, older friend, that nothing's going to come easy. Getting to the top in any area of endeavor is difficult. And I think a lot of that is missing in LeBron. He's young enough, certainly, and gifted enough to learn these things. But the idea that because you have been called the Chosen One or King James, you are actually going to achieve greatness seems entirely mistaken to me, at total odds with the way the world works. I don't know if he gets it, and I think a lot of that is because he had no one in his life to help him learn.
My guest is Scott Robb. He's the author of The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. Get to your calls, 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call with a question or comment for Scott, and also your emails when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Army Staff Sergeant Scott Carr remembers the scariest moments he lived through.
They're on both sides of us, on both, you know, in the houses, on top of the roofs. A lot of shooting.
He says while he stays out of the politics of why the war began in Iraq, he has mixed emotions about it.
I think if you open a can of worms, you better finish it till it's done. Right, wrong.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's Tech Tuesday. We'll discuss the Facebook timeline, the best airports for technology, and we'll have some holiday gift ideas. For those last-minute shoppers, it's Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. And join our station tonight for Hanukkah Lights 2011. It's a perennial NPR favorite where acclaimed authors explore Hanukkah stories written expressly for this special. Listen to Hanukkah Lights 2011. It's tonight at 9 on 89.7 NPR News. 41 degrees with some light rain. Expect showers off and on throughout the day and a high of 47. Rain is still likely tonight. Steady temperatures right around 40 degrees. And more rain for tomorrow, warmer though, and a high of 58 degrees for tomorrow. And the rain continues tomorrow night, should be decreasing by Thursday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Scott Robb. He's the author of The Whore of Akron, One of Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. He's also a writer for Esquire magazine. Scott, I wanted to listen to LeBron a little bit more. He left the Cavaliers. He's saying that he left the Cavaliers to win, and he explains that.
Like I said before, I feel like it's going to give me the best opportunity to win and to win for multiple years. And not only just to win in a regular season or just to win five games in a row or three games in a row. I want to be able to win championships, and I feel like I can compete down there.
And, of course, you know, he still hasn't captured that NBA championship that he left the Cavs for. And, you know, you just mentioned just because you're the chosen one doesn't mean he ever will.
It's striking because you don't have to be a Clevelander or Cleveland Cavs fan or a LeBron hater to have watched the NBA Finals last year and to see LeBron fall apart in the fourth quarter of four consecutive games and really lose the finals, the championship for his team. There was something of Aristotelian catharsis about it, the pity and terror of seeing a hero, not my hero, but a hero, brought low by the inevitability of fate because of his flaw. I know that's you know, putting a lot on it, but it's amazing that in a situation, I know it was their first year together and all of that, but they had rolled like a juggernaut through the first rounds of the playoffs. And it was really a cleansing kind of experience. I was down in Miami for the end of that series, saw it unfold. And one of the things, and I felt a great deal of schadenfreude. I think the Germans must have an even better word for what I was feeling. But there's a strangeness about the whole thing. He may go on and win multiple championships, but it will always be my belief that it would have happened in Cleveland, at least one championship, and that one in Cleveland would have cemented his legacy forever in terms of sports, and not just in Cleveland. I think millions of fans around the world love that story and would have regarded him as an all-time great, as opposed to how he will be regarded no matter how many championships he wins now, which is someone who betrayed his hometown.
You cry a few times in this story. You're an emotional person. You sound real calm, cool, and collected right now, but I know you're an emotional person from reading the book. And stacked up against someone like LeBron James, the subject of your book ostensibly, it's like fire and ice. And, of course, you know, you do write a lot about yourself and your struggles. Growing up without a dad was felt like in the end the least of the troubles sometimes.
There was a lot to overcome. Now, you could knock on any door and find the horrors far greater than any I endured as a kid, but it wasn't a good childhood. It was a violent household. It was a miserably unhappy household, an immigrant household where people really, really went at it physically. So there was that part of things, and then, you know, just the biochemical stuff. I've been in recovering guy for 17 years. So, you know, there are parts of me, and I think I came out the other side. I love my job, love the family. I'm grateful on a daily basis for all the good stuff I have and that's happened to me. But there is that sense of an open-hearted approach to life that I don't know if it's possible for anyone of LeBron's celebrity status to have on any kind of public basis. But, yeah, I cry a lot, often from joy, especially as mm-hmm. a father. It's the most redemptive experience I've ever known, and I easily could have missed it. I didn't become a dad until I was 47. But I never have relinquished that attachment both to Cleveland and to Cleveland sports. And when I go back there, and I go back pretty often now, there are people who begin thanking me because Cleveland hasn't had a lot of people in the national media stand up and go, wait a second. And they start crying. And then I start crying. So, yeah, there's a lot of that I'm fond of saying to some of the coaches of the teams my son plays for, we cry a lot at our house.
It's all good. D in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm from the Akron area as well, but how much role did Jay Brophy have, a high school coach? And did you feel like most of the great athletes that came out of Akron, sports teams, football or basketball, they always seemed to have some type of sidekick? There was always one or two good players on each team, but he just seemed like the only one. You think that?
It's really hard. It's hard to claim not just historical knowledge when it comes to what happens to people, to human beings that you don't really know. And I'm certainly far more familiar with LeBron and his story than anyone else, but I think it really does become like a self-protective thing. I mean, you've got your friends, and you've got the people that you know knew you when. And whatever they're going to gain in terms of a little bit of glamour, a little bit of money, whatever, from your own fame, your own stature, and your own wealth, that's okay because you can trust those guys. And I'm not sure, you know, in a culture of celebrity, it really is, you know, shallow and kind of pervasive. I've talked to TV and movie actors and musicians and other people. The only people that they trust are the people they came up with. And I think this is what happens. It's terribly limiting. It kind of locks you into a way of being that's childish and walled off from anything I would recognize as reality, but it seems to be part of what goes with the package.
Thanks, Dee, for that call. Appreciate it. An email from Bob. He asks, why hasn't ESPN covered or reviewed your book, Scott Rob?
Very interesting. The book is unkind to ESPN, and because it's written as a bitter screed from a Cleveland fan in terms of ESPN, the book has gotten reviewed twice by the Wall Street Journal, the Christian Science Monitor, the Associated Press, Sports Illustrated, the worldwide leader, ESPN, which has an entire cadre of reporters that work at something called the Heat Index, has basically behaved as if no such book was published. I'm a big boy. I've been in the national media really 25 years now, and I understand what's going on. It doesn't mean I have to like it, and it doesn't mean that I'm not going to continue making some noise about it, because I would like to think, yes, I care about selling books, but yes, I also care about credible journalism. And the problem with an entity like ESPN, which is a business partner to every major college conference and professional sports league in the country, is that at the same time they're supposedly providing credible coverage, news coverage of this business, they are locked into extremely lucrative contracts, not just with the franchises and the colleges, but with the apparel manufacturers, the shoe manufacturers, the sport drink manufacturers, and to claim at the same time that we're simply a multi-platform entertainment and sports outlet, and we can build firewalls That's ludicrous, and any grown-up who believes it, you know, really needs to get a clue. So ignoring the LeBron book is merely a symptom. They've also managed to ignore far more egregious stories, like the Syracuse assistant basketball coach who was a sexual predator. ESPN knew about that for nearly a decade and did nothing about it.
Email from Anthony. This one's over my head, but I'm sure you'll get it, Scott. Thoughts on Dan Gilbert and some of his antics in the aftermath of the decision, and also recently in the vetoed Chris Paul trade to the Lakers, sending an email to the commissioner. Seems as though he will do everything in his power to prevent what happened to him from happening to another owner and small market team.
I think Dan Gilbert, I've only met a few pure entrepreneurs in my life in the course of my writing. Dan is one of them. These guys become billionaires by dint of a drive that I'm not sure I could ever fully understand. So when Dan had to deal with the decision, when Dan found himself with no leverage whatsoever, when Dan found himself losing, depending on the source, $100 million, at least on paper, due to LeBron's decision to leave, I think Dan felt personally betrayed, and so he sent a letter. He was fined $100,000 by the commissioner of the NBA for the letter he sent to the fans of Cleveland, and it was relentlessly, it was an assault on LeBron's character. And more recently, when one of the teams owned by the league and therefore owned in part by Dan Gilbert was proposing a trade, the commissioner vetoed the trade, and Dan has been blamed for being one of the voices crying loudest against this trade. So, you know, antics is a funny word. Dan types his stuff in a font called Comic Sans, and he has become in many ways a national joke. But for a Cleveland fan, Dan Gilbert is a beloved owner. He's got a passionate commitment to the city and to trying to finally win a championship, and he's willing to back that up with oodles of money. So we love Dan. As far as I think I can speak for a lot of Cleveland fans, not all, but many and most, say Dan Gilbert's our kind of guy. Please, Dan, buy the Cleveland Indians and the Cleveland Browns, too. Please.
From Steve on Facebook, he says, no comprendo LeBrondo in our household. He went from star to outcast, not so much for leaving, but for how he did it and how he just gave up in the finals for the Cavs. I don't even like pro basketball that much, but having grown up with a lot of bad pro teams in Cleveland, LeBron brought a lot of hope and pride to the region. I have to admit, watching Dallas beat Miami in the finals actually felt good.
It felt great in a lot of ways. And I think it's important, especially going back to the question about Cleveland's overall despair and how meaningless sports or how trivial sports really are in that context. I think it's important that 20,562 fans packed Quicken Loans Arena every night the Cavs played. Their hearts were full of hope, and their wallets were full of money. And there were restaurants that were basically built on LeBron James's back. And there was a sense, whether you lived in Akron, Avon Lake, Rocky River, Hunting Valley, all those suburbs in the metropolitan area, we were all Clevelanders again. That's not devoid of meaning, especially when times are tough.
Yeah, you said the idea that Cleveland, once again, is a receptacle for pity enrages you.
I'm all bark. It's not that my bark is worse than my bite, but after December 2nd, 2010, when the Miami Heat came back to Cleveland and just beat down the Cavaliers not only didn't put up much of a fight, but they basically, well, literally, a couple of them hugged LeBron before the game. After that game, one of the Miami guys, and a guy I like very much, said, you know, I feel sorry for Cleveland. And it was all I could do to keep from punching him. Because I don't know that, at least for me, and again, it's projection from my own experience, mostly as a kid when people called it a broken home. Man, I'm upset. I'm hurt. I'm angry. I'm full of yearning and rage. I do not want to hear how sorry you feel for me. And I think, you know, that's kind of how Cleveland is. There were people in the media who kept talking about LeBron's return that night in December 2010 as potentially a riot. And oh, my God, Cleveland, don't give yourself a black eye. The same media who, first of all, have been portraying Cleveland as a backwoods sinkhole for 40 or 50 years, and the same media who are talking relentlessly about the possibility of violence but would never hold themselves accountable were violence to occur. So, you know, there is a sense, it's global and then sometimes it's specific, of don't tell me how sorry you feel for me. It does not make me feel better, and it certainly doesn't make me feel more kindly toward you.
Getting back to the finals for the Cavs, the assessment that he just gave up in the finals for the Cavs, someone else in the book that you quoted, and it might have been yourself, but that it wasn't really given up, that he actually chokes when that kind of pressure is on him.
And there are sports writers who've covered him for years with far more knowledge than I, and some of them were willing, of course, to share that knowledge with me. The team had always been concerned about, there were physical manifestations of the playoff pressure he felt for years, back spasms, shingles, chronic indigestion. Despite all that, he often performed at historically great levels in any given game in the playoffs. But what looked in 2010, when he finished his career with the Cavs, like it might have been a guy who quit on the team, I think turned out, in view of last year's performance with Miami, where he really did crumble and fall apart in four consecutive games, it wasn't a guy who wasn't trying. It was a guy who really was choking at the moments of greatest pressure. He did not want the ball in his hands and turned from one of the most aggressive and really kind of frightening players on the court to a very meek guy who couldn't wait to pass the ball to a less talented teammate. He simply didn't want to play.
Just a couple of quick asides. We're running out of time, but how did your wife like the book?
Well, we have some issues, and they're not, you know, in the context of a lifelong commitment, there's certainly nothing that rises to any serious level. But, you know, like a stand-up comic who's going to do 10 or 15 minutes up on stage and talk about his marriage, you know, you kind of have to talk about those things, and Lisa and I have. I'm more concerned about my mom, who really has looked at this book as kind of a mommy dearest. That's kind of how my mom's built. And, you know, it's funny because I understood back when I was a fiction writer, I didn't come up as a newspaper or a journalist guy, I understood that sometimes, you know, when things get autobiographical, you make this decision that you don't really care how people feel. But in real life, you get to my age and you realize how much you love folks, and then you still go ahead and write it. That doesn't speak well for me, but I'm trying to work that stuff out.
Scott Robb, thanks a lot for joining us. I've enjoyed it.
Oh, me too, Ann. Thanks for having me. Happy holidays to one and all.
Thank you. Scott Robb, author of The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.